Good day and welcome everyone to today's internet seminar on green remediation, sponsored by the Green Remediation Subcommittee of EPA's Engineering Forum. My name is Michael Gill, and I'm the Superfund Technology Liaison in EPA's Region 9 office in San Francisco. I'll be moderating today's session titled Green Remediation, Applying Strategies in the Field. This is the second of this three-part seminar series. The last one will be held on December 15th. We'll get started in just a few moments. While we wait for others to log on, I'd like to cover a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to this seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We've also included short bio sketches of the presenters. Please note that the presenters' email addresses are hot linked on that page in case you have any questions for them after today's presentation. For those of you joining us via the phone lines, we request that you put your phone on mute for the seminar. We will have Q&A sessions after each speaker, at which point you'll be welcome to take your phone off mute and ask your question. If you do not have a mute button on your phone, we ask that you take a moment right now to hit *6 to place your phone on mute. When we get to the question and answer periods, you can hit #6 to unmute the phone. This will greatly reduce the background noise that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. So again, keep us on mute, but do not put us on hold. By now, all of you have clicked on the agenda for today's go-to session icon and should be on slide number 1 of the presentation. The main page contains the slides above which you will find navigation icons. You may submit questions by using the question mark icon you see above the slide. You need not wait until the Q&A period to submit your questions. In fact, we encourage you to submit in advance of the Q&A session. Also, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question mark icon to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include the phone number where you can be reached, and we'll try to help you troubleshoot your problem. The presenter will be announcing the number of the slide to which she or he is moving. You may advance to the next slide using the single right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. As stated earlier, we will have question sessions after each speaker, and at the end of all the presentations, we'll walk you through our links to the additional resources page, where we have assembled a series of documents, databases, and websites directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. Lastly, this event will be recorded and archived on the CLUIN website. Within 1 to 2 weeks, you'll be able to download it in several formats or replay it online. Subscribe to our CLUIN podcast to receive new archived seminars as they become available at cluin.org/live. So let's kick off this session. In January of this year, EPA held its annual National Association of Remedial Project Managers meeting in Atlanta, Georgia. We call it NARPM. And like last year, one of our most attended sessions was on green remediation. Because of its success, members of EPA's technical support project, led by the Engineering Forum, have taken this full-day session and are bringing back the same talks as online seminars this fall. And this is the second of three sessions. EPA's definition of green remediation includes the practice of considering the environmental effects of a remediation strategy, in effect the remedy selected and the implementation approach, early in the process and incorporating options to maximize the net environmental benefit of the cleanup action. Some practices are quite mature, such as construction site best management practices, including stormwater runoff management and construction and demolition debris recycling. Others are still emerging, including the use of renewable energy sources, such as wind and solar, to power remediation systems. Over the three sessions, the online training that we're doing here are introducing you to the key policy, technical, and application aspects of green remediation. Before I turn it over to our first speaker, I remind phone participants to put your phones on mute. If you don't have a mute button on your phone, hit *6 now. And again, please don't put us on hold. Today's first speaker is Stephanie Vaughn from EPA's Region 2 office in New York City. After working at a small consulting firm in Massachusetts performing human health risk assessments, Stephanie joined EPA in 1998, where she's been an RPM in the New Jersey branch of the Superfund Division for nearly 12 years. During her time at EPA, she has managed several fund and PRP lead sites through all phases of the remedial process. She's been a member of the engineering forum since 2006 and a co-chair of the forum since 2008. Stephanie is also actively involved with several regional and national green remediation-related work groups, including the Region 2 Green Remediation Work Group and the Engineering Forum's Green Remediation Subcommittee. Stephanie received her bachelor's and master's degrees in environmental engineering from MIT. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you, everyone, for joining us. Today I'm going to talk about the Region 2 Clean and Green Policy. I can't seem to progress my slides. Okay, there we go. Going to slide 2, the policy was signed on March 17, 2009 by the Director of the Emergency and Remedial Response Division here at EPA Region 2 in New York. The stated purpose of the policy was to enhance the environmental benefits of federal cleanup programs by promoting technologies and practices that are sustainable. Going to slide 3. As a start, the policy requires the use of 4 approaches at all sites, unless a site-specific evaluation would demonstrate that it's either impracticable or that an alternative green approach would be better. The division director wanted to...
We're still here. Are you there, Stephanie? Gene, are you there? Gene Vallant?
Michael, this is Matthew Montes. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Hi, Matthew. I'm here, yeah.
Okay.
I think others might be automatically muted, so they can't speak up, but Gene has control of that.
I see, okay.
Stephanie, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, I'm sorry. My phone died, or just I lost the connection just as we were starting.
You're on. Go ahead.
Okay,
thank
I
you.
Apologize. Did you hear any of what I was saying?
Yes, just missed about 30 seconds. So.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure if it was the whole thing.
Slide 3.
Okay. Let me just go back to slide 3. Apologize about that. Okay. The division director basically wanted to pick some initial approaches or technologies that would be easy to implement at most or all sites so that we could get going on this implementing a green remediation strategy right away. The policy applies to all Superfund sites in the region, whether they be EPA lead, PRP lead, or federal facilities, as well as to RCRA corrective action sites and brownfields cleanups. And as I just kind of applied, the additional approaches will be added to the list of required practices over time. The 4 immediately required technologies or practices that the policy includes are, 1, obtaining 100% of your electricity from renewable resources or from renewably generated electricity. In New York and New Jersey, this translates mainly to purchasing renewably generated electricity or renewable energy credits for your site. The second approach is the use of clean diesel fuel practices and technologies. Third is the use of green concrete made with coal combustion products, replacing a portion of the Portland cement. And the final of the initial required practices is capture of methane at landfills. In order to implement the policy, we formed a green remediation work group within the region. The work group was divided into 5 subgroups that I will go through shortly. I'm on slide 5 now, I apologize. And it's important to note that the work group is comprised of individuals from almost every division within the region to allow for cross-divisional knowledge exchange. We realized quickly that people in other divisions other than Superfund knew a lot more about things like clean diesel and alternative energy than we did. So we wanted to learn from that and not reinvent the wheel. Going to slide 6. The first of the two subgroups that I'll talk about are technical and outreach training. We needed to learn ourselves how to implement these green remediation practices and then communicate that information to the project managers in the region. So to do so, we are developing a series of technical training guidances for the use of project managers, coupled with training sessions in the region. The first of these training sessions was held on April 23rd, and it related to clean diesel. And the second of these training sessions was supposed to be held this past Tuesday, but it got delayed, and it will now be held in early December. And that training may be available via webinar if people are interested. The next two subgroups I'll discuss are the policy and legal. Basically, we are requiring incorporation of green remediation language into all new RODs, records of decisions, and enforcement agreements with PRPs, potentially responsible parties. And so far this year, since the policy was signed in March, we've already incorporated green remediation language into 7 RODs and 7 enforcement agreements. Alternatively, we are requesting that PRPs already working under an existing order comply with the policy. Just last week, our division director sent out a letter to all RPMs that is kind of a form letter that we're supposed to send to our PRPs requesting that they do comply with the policy. The next subgroup that we formed was a contract subgroup, looking into ways to get green remediation language into our subcontracts. Language has been added to all of our new RACs, remedial action contracts, and interagency agreements with the Corps. Existing contracts will be updated with green remediation language as they need to be updated. We have successfully been working with the Corps and our contractors to implement and track the success of the policy, and we are working to incorporate this language into contracts for other programs. And I should say that the Corps has been, and both the Corps and the contractors have been very cooperative in both implementing the policy and in helping us track the information. The final subgroup I'll mention is the metric subgroup. This is the group working on ways of measuring success. We've tentatively identified metrics for each of the initial required practices, and we've received funding to work with a contractor to track the metrics. They're going to help us develop a database to not only keep track of the data we need, but also to ease the process of the RPMs getting us that information. For now, both the contractors and the Corps are keeping track of information such as kilowatt hours used and costs for electricity in their standard monthly progress reports. So, I'm sorry, I haven't been saying the slide. I'm on slide 10 now. So far, many sites in the region have already implemented aspects of the policy. Purchase of renewably generated electricity has been the most widely implemented. In May, we looked at data from 16 core managed sites in New York and New Jersey, and we obtained both monthly average kilowatt hour usage and cost data from these sites. We did an evaluation of this data to make sure that in aggregate the added cost of purchasing renewably generated electricity would not be too great. And a determination was made that it wasn't. So we continued with implementing the policy and going to slide 11. Since the time of that analysis in May, we have recently compiled data on 12 sites, 6 of which have already switched to purchasing 100% renewable energy or renewably generated electricity for use at their site. more switching every day, and actually since the time that I created this presentation, we are now up to 9 sites that have switched to purchasing renewably generated electricity. And so the good thing is now we have some real cost data and some real information on how difficult this aspect of the policy is to implement. Going to slide 12, we compared the cost of switching to renewable energy to the carbon emissions offset by doing so. I won't go through all the data in this slide to save some time, but basically of the 6 sites that have already switched to the purchase of renewably generated electricity, by doing so, they are already offsetting 167 metric tons of carbon emissions. This is a 17% reduction for the sites evaluated, and it only translates to a 4% increase in cost. So current data shows that we've already offset 333 metric tons of carbon. And if you use one of the online calculators on the EPA website, that's the equivalent of taking 61 cars off the road, the electricity of 46 homes, or the carbon sequestered by 76 acres of forest. So there's still a long way to go, but we feel progress has been made. And that's it for my presentation. If you have any questions, you can find the policy at the website shown, or feel free to call or send me an email.
Thank you, Stephanie. What we're going to do now is alternate time we have for a few questions between the phone and online. I don't see any online questions, so we have one in the room now.
Hey, Stephanie. Hi. Steve Tyler from Region 9, obviously, since I'm in a room with Mike. The question I have is, I'm intrigued by the fact that your policy, you're making it required in RODs and in enforcement agreements, and I'm curious as to how, you know, if I'm playing big bad PRP and I don't want to play ball and it's going to cost me money, how can you really compel that unless it's an error, or maybe you viewed a policy as a TBC? Explain how you can really compel that if a PRP doesn't want to play ball.
Sure. We are actually, we're including it in the, hold on one moment. Okay, sorry, I'm putting you back on speaker. The question was, how can we compel a PRP to comply with the policy, basically, if we're putting it in the RODs? That's a good question. We're including it, and this is kind of a tricky area. We are including it in the proposed plan analysis, but not as one of the 9 criteria. We're looking at it as part of the 9 criteria, but not as an additional criteria. For example, short-term effect. Well, I don't have the specific. There are 2 in particular that we're focusing on. I believe short-term effectiveness and community relations. Perhaps long-term effectiveness as well. We're putting this language into the proposed plan, and so it is undergoing public comment, and you'd need to speak with, I could put you in touch with other people who are dealing more closely with that aspect of the policy.
Stephanie, any other, there's still no comment from online. Oh, there is one question from online here. How does the Region 2 policy tie in with the recent Oswer Green cleanup principles?
Well, we are working concurrently. Our work group has people who are on the headquarters Oswer work group, so we are aware of the Oswer policy, and we want to work in tandem with it, not against it. That said, our division director felt strongly that he wanted to get going on this right away and implement some things in our region quickly. So we'll try to track the progress and make sure both move along and help each other and don't contradict each other.
Or from the phone line here.
Where would I go to find examples of language that you're putting into the orders and to the PRPs?
If you send me an email, I can send you some stuff. We I don't believe it's up on our intranet site yet, and I'm not sure you could get it there. But I'd be happy to send you some sample language.
From the phone?
Yeah. Did you have a documentation of the evaluation that you went through to determine the cost-benefit analysis of switching to the renewable energy that you mentioned back in May that you had done that?
Sure. Actually, I could share the presentation that I will be giving in a couple weeks whenever we reschedule it. That runs through the analysis. And if you have any additional questions, I'd be happy to talk to you about them.
Okay.
A couple from online. This is from Zach Schreiber, the Mayor's Office of Environmental Remediation in New York City. Is the 4% cost increase for renewable purchasing with respect to the total energy costs, total project costs, or with respect only to electricity costs?
Good question. That is with respect only to the electricity costs. On average, we are finding that the additional cost per kilowatt hour is 2 cents for the purchase of renewably generated electricity, or really renewable energy certificates is what we're doing in New York and New Jersey. The average additional cost to per site per year due to this purchase is about $7,000, but there's a wide variation in cost depending on the amount of electricity the site uses.
Also from Zach, are renewables for these projects primarily hydropower?
There are a variety. You can actually make a choice. It seems winds and hydro provide most of the renewable energy.
People can get a lot more information online, too, at the cluin.org/green remediation webpage. That's just a reminder. Also from online, why are switching to renewable energy the most commonly adopted strategy at these sites? Why were other green remediation approaches not widely used at the sites?
Well, this is we're hoping the other approaches will be used more widely. I think the reason the renewable energy was the first adopted is because it's just the easiest, particularly in New York and New Jersey. New Jersey has a program, the New Jersey Clean Choice Program, I believe it's called, whereby you just go to the web to a website and you can click on a link and fill out a form. It's a little more complicated than that, we found, but basically you can sign up through your local utility provider, and this charge will appear as an additional line item on your bill. So it's very easy to do.
Two more questions. One from the phone. Anybody on the phone have a question? I'll take that as no. There is one more online. This is from Amita Patel at Malcolm Perney in Fairlawn, New Jersey. I'm working on a Superfund project currently in New Jersey, remediation of radioactive material by excavating and transferring the material. How do I find out what kind of technologies can we implement to our project?
Well, I guess my suggestion would be to... If you send me an email, I could send you the information we have so far, and this is all still a work in progress, so we don't have too much clear guidance to actually send you, but I could be happy to talk to you about your project and provide you with any suggestions.
And Stephanie's email address is at the on the last page there of her presentation. We'll go with one more since it just popped in here from online. Is it possible to get a website reference that further describes the U.S. Army Corps projects that have implemented renewable energy? This is from Susan Newton at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment.
I'm thinking, I don't think there's a web link that I could send you, but we could send you, I could send you contact information for the people I've been dealing with at the Corps if you'd like to ask them some questions, and or I could send you the sites that have switched. So again, I keep saying send me an email, but feel free, and I'll respond soon. It'll take me a few days, but soon.
Okay, let's move on to our second speaker. Our second speaker is Ginny Lombardo, who's been with Bay Region 1's office in Boston for 18 years. She has a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering, a master's degree in environmental engineering, and a PE in environmental engineering. Ginny has worked in the water division, the RCRA division, and brownfields programs, and has been at Federal Facilities RPM for the past 5 years. Now it's time for Ginny. Please don't forget to mention your slide numbers. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on.
Thank you, Mike. Good afternoon, everyone. As Mike mentioned, we are on slide 14. My name is Ginny Lombardo. I am a Federal Facility RPM at EPA Region 1 in Boston. One of the sites that I oversee is the Fort Devens Army installation. This is a BRAC site where major parts of the former base have been transferred for public-private redevelopment, although the Army does still retain the South Post area and several hundred acres of the former main post for Army Reserve Forces training. I am going to talk to you today about the Shepley's Hill landfill site. At this site, there is a groundwater pump and treat system in operation. In order to evaluate how to green this pump and treat system, the region completed a remediation system evaluation, which is a systematic evaluation looking for opportunities for improved energy efficiency and to reduce costs. Please move on to slide 15. Just wanted to review some background information with you on the landfill. It's an 80-acre unlined landfill. It was operated from as early as 1917 into the 1990s. It was used for the disposal of municipal waste, construction debris, and incinerator ash. The record of decision was signed in 1995. It called for a geomembrane and soil capping system, and it included a contingency remedy for groundwater extraction if risk reduction criteria related to arsenic were not met. At the time of the 2005-year review, it was concluded that the risk reduction criteria were not going to be met by the timeline established in the ROD, and that the contingency remedy was needed to be implemented. So the groundwater pump and treat system was designed, installed, and began operation in 2005. It operates at 50 gallons per minute, and it treats for arsenic. Looking at the aerial photograph that I have there of the landfill, just to orient you, the pump and treat system is located at the north end of the landfill. Just further north of that is the boundary of the Army's property, and the town of Ayer, Massachusetts is beyond that boundary. On the west side is Shepley's Hill, which is a bedrock outcrop. East of the landfill is Plowshot Pond, and there is groundwater contamination that enters the pond and has impacted the area there, shown as Red Cove. And south of the site is new industrial development, and groundwater flows north-northeast. The main chemical of concern at the site is arsenic, which is very high, up to 4,000 parts per billion in deep groundwater. The arsenic source possibilities are the landfill itself and also from naturally occurring arsenic in the aquifer materials and bedrock. This landfill is located in what is referred to as the Central Massachusetts Arsenic Belt. And combining the natural arsenic with the reducing conditions caused by the landfill liberates arsenic into the groundwater from overburden and bedrock. Please move on to slide 16. As I mentioned, we completed an evaluation of the pump and treat system at the Shepley's Hill landfill through a process called a remediation system evaluation. Useful references to review on this process are EPA's guidance titled Optimization Strategies for Long-Term Groundwater Remedies, and also the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers document entitled Remediation System Evaluation Checklist. The Corps developed the RSC process back in 1995. Links to both of those documents are posted on the resources webpage that Mike referred to, so we'll be providing information on that at the end of the seminar. The RFP process is laid out on this slide. An independent team of experts comes to the site to evaluate the remedy for optimization opportunities. They conduct a review of all relevant reports, site inspection, and interviews of site stakeholders. They evaluate subsurface and treatment plant performance relative to remedial goals, verify the site exit strategy, and generate a report with recommendations on protectiveness, cost effectiveness, technical improvements, site closure, and sustainability. Since 2000, EPA nationally has completed numerous RFPs at fund lead sites, mostly sites with pump and treat systems, to evaluate ways to optimize the treatment systems and save energy and money. Also on the resources page that Mike referred to, there will be a link provided to the CLUIN page titled Remediation Optimization. And on that CLUIN page, there are PDF files for all of the RFPs that have been conducted historically by EPA across the country. I will have the document that I'm talking about today will also be added there as soon as I can get that added on there.
A quick interruption. Please remind people, don't forget to mute your phone, star 6. Thank you. We can hear some background noise. Sorry, Jenny.
That's okay. Moving on to slide 17. At Shepley's Hill Landfill, we wanted to add a green remediation twist to the RSC process. The original RSC process was focused on optimization for cost savings purposes and often resulted in a greener remedy due to energy efficiencies implemented as a result of the effort. However, we wanted the primary driver to be energy efficiency and greenhouse gas reductions that should be considered whether or not there was a cost savings. At the landfill, we had some specific concerns. The data that we had evaluated was showing that the groundwater pump and treat system was not capturing all of the plume, so we had concerns about capture zone and whether or not and the capacity of the treatment system. We also had concerns about sustainability, since the arsenic source. Is at least partly due to naturally occurring arsenic, which could be an almost unlimited source in the aquifer materials. There was concern that the system would need to be run indefinitely. So there was a concern about sustainability, long-term sustainability of the system. And we were also interested in whether or not the treatment system could be operated utilizing renewable energy to run the system. So we wanted those things evaluated as part of the RSC process. So we added a few additional components to the RSC. Those were considerations to address the green remediation core elements, consideration of the environmental footprint of the remedy, and evaluating the use of renewable energy to power the system. Please turn ahead to slide 18. Just to give some context, I want to review some basics of the pump and treat system at Shepley's so that when we do go over the recommendations that were made, you have some background on the size and specifications of the system. As I mentioned when we were looking at the aerial, the system is located at the north end of the landfill. There are two extraction wells that are operated for a total flow of 50 gallons per minute. Arsenic is removed through precipitation with iron and microfiltration. The process chemicals used are sodium chloride and chlorine gas. Influent arsenic is about 3,200 parts per billion, and the discharging effluent is under the MCL. There's a lamella plate clarifier for solid thickening. Solid dewatering is done with a filter bottom container. And then sludge at about 8% solids is transported off-site for disposal. And all of this is housed in a 40 by 40 steel building with electric heat. Please turn to slide 19. I wanted to thank Geotrans, Incorporated. Geotrans is the contractor that EPA hired to do this work, and Doug Sutton and Rob Greenwald of Geotrans were the primary authors. So I want to acknowledge them. The slides that I'll go into next will present the findings and recommendations. The report was finalized in August of 2009, and it has been shared with the Army and other site stakeholders. And in the future slides, I'm going to refer to this report as the RSE/GR report or evaluation. Now let's get to some data and the findings and recommendations of the evaluation and the status of those recommendations. Please turn to slide 20. Although we wanted the focus to be green, regardless of cost implications, looking at costs first is always important because energy efficiencies and greenhouse gas reductions can very often be realized by evaluating the major costs and looking for cost savings. So as a first step, we itemized the major annual O&M costs, and they are listed on this table. The electricity usage is about 120,000 kilowatt hours per year, and that relates at this site to about $25,000 per year. The chemical costs, the major ones were sodium chloride at $40,000 a year and chlorine gas at $11,000 a year. Waste disposal, which is primarily due to the sludge that shipped off site, is a cost of about $74,000 per year. And the water discharge due to fees associated with the POTW is around $80,000 per year. Please turn to slide 21. Okay, step two. Since we are trying to add a focus on energy and greenhouse gas reduction in this evaluation, we needed to itemize carbon costs by calculating the carbon footprint associated with the different components or processes of the pump and treat system. The treatment system was broken down into different components or processes, and those are shown in the first column. Then the carbon footprint in pounds of CO2 emitted per year was calculated, and these are the numbers in the second column. The third and fourth columns on the table present the percentage contribution of the carbon footprint for each component or process so that the major players in the carbon cost picture can be identified. Since landfill gas emissions are an important consideration when looking at greenhouse gases, we also estimated the carbon footprint associated with just the passive emissions from the landfill, so that the relative magnitude of this could be compared to that of the pump and treat system. The percentages presented in the fourth column represent the inclusion of the passive landfill gas emissions. As you can see, considering landfill gas along with the pump and treat system components, the landfill gas represents 20% of the carbon footprint of the landfill. The other major players are electricity, the material sodium chloride, the POTW discharge, and methane off-gassing from treated water. Note that the footprint associated with the diesel is primarily a result of transport of sodium chloride to the site and transport of sludge off-site for disposal. Please turn to slide 22. These first set of recommendations were related to improving the effectiveness of the system. As I mentioned, there were concerns with system capture. The pump and treat system was not capturing the entire plume. It was not operating at the 50 gallons per minute that it was designed to operate at. Just prior to us EPA completing this RSE effort, the Army did implement some improvements to the system, and they were able to improve the system to operate at about 45 gallons per minute, but it's still not operating on average at the 50 gallon per minute design rate. There were also issues related to the model that was being used at the site. Model results were unreliable. There was an unacceptable mass balance error. And the model suggested that groundwater on the eastern side of the landfill was not being captured. So recommendations included revising the groundwater flow model and recalibrating it and collecting some new data to do that, increasing plume capture by possibly reinjecting treated water down gradient of the pump and treat system. This would have an added cost benefit. And if it was needed to reach the capture that's required, to also look at increasing system capacity. And if that was to be pursued, recommendations were that a large clarifier would be a better alternative than the microfiltration unit, and also that a filter press should be considered to improve dewatering. We're going to move on to slide 23. These are the set of recommendations to reduce costs. Like I mentioned on the last slide, reinjecting water has a significant cost implication. So a recommendation was made to either reinject treated water or to look at surface water discharge. The cost savings here is a little lower than on the prior slide because there is some cost associated with the engineering work that would need to be completed in order to do on-site injection or surface water discharge here. Another recommendation was to look at alternative chemical usage. Currently, at the site, sodium chloride in the form of ATCA Chlor 25 is used. That's what's specified by the vendor. However, that chemical comes from a distant supplier and includes a 20-cent per pound freight cost. So there was a recommendation to evaluate other 25% sodium chloride solutions. In addition, for the chlorine dioxide, it was also suggested that they evaluate sodium hypochlorite. That had been looked at bench scale tests in the design stage and was dismissed as an idea. But when relooking at that data, it was thought that that should be re-looked at. And those would have significant cost implications if those were changed. The other recommendation was to modify the solids handling practices by installing a filter press, and the filter press would be able to achieve a 30% solid in the sludge rather than the 8% that's currently achieved, and it was estimated that there would be a 5-year payback if that change was made. And there's also an associated 18,000 pounds per year reduction of CO2 emissions if that was implemented. And note also that there are carbon footprint reductions associated with the chemical usage changes if those were implemented. Okay, we're going to move on to slide 24. Recommendations were made also for improved sustainability. These were focused at greening the overall remedy and primarily driven by CO2 emissions reductions. The first recommendation was to use a water source heat pump for building heat. They could realize a 75% reduction of electrical usage if that was installed, and there's an associated $4,500 per year cost reduction and a reduction in the carbon footprint of about 35,000 pounds of CO2 per year if that was installed. The other recommendation was the use of solar spark flares to combust the passive methane emissions, and the cost of those would be about $40,000 for 8 of those to be used across the site. Moving on to slide 25. As I stated when discussing the green remediation twist we added to this remediation system evaluation, we wanted to consider renewable energy to power the treatment system. However, during the evaluation, it came to our attention that the Army Corps, under a separate project, is considering siting renewable energy systems at this landfill to power a new Armed Forces Reserve Center that is under construction. So we have been in touch with those folks. And if that project does go forward, the Corps has agreed to include powering of the treatment system in that overall project. However, for the purpose of the RSC, we did look at the economics of installation of renewable energy in the form of either wind or solar that would be used just to power the treatment system. What was considered was a 100 kilowatt system, and the payback was between 12 to 15 years for those systems. If the Army is able to enter into a third-party partnership for that so that they can realize the 30% federal tax credit, the payback for those comes closer to 10 years. Note that landfill methane to energy was not viable here since the landfill is very old, the methane generation process is decreasing, and there is no central gas collection system. There's only passive venting. Please turn to slide 26. The RSC GR evaluation report was issued on August 21st, 2009. So that was only a couple of months ago. As I mentioned, I'll get a PDF link of the report and have that included on the resources page for this webinar. EPA Region 1, the Army, and MassDEP found this to be a valuable exercise. In addition, the public stakeholders appreciated the work and were pleased that the Army has agreed to implement several of the recommendations. As shown on the slide, the Army is preparing to conduct a supplemental investigation effort and looking at completing a new feasibility study to look at remedial alternatives to address issues with the current remedy, and that investigation and supplemental feasibility study will consider several of the recommendations from this report, including revising the groundwater flow model, looking at reinjecting groundwater, and looking at increasing system capacity, considering both installing a large clarifier and installing a filter press. The Army has also agreed to consider installation of a water source heat pump for building heat. For the sodium chlorite, the Army did evaluate the chemical usage change, but they were unable to implement that due to issues with area suppliers. And related to renewable energy, the Army is awaiting the finalized plans on the Armed Forces Reserve Center renewable system to see if that moves forward. I suspect many of you have heard that green remediation can be considered at every stage of the CERCLA process. However, the majority of CERCLA sites have a remedy in place and are in LTM stages, so it's too late to apply the concept of green remediation to the remedy selection and design stages. But it's not too late to step back and look at remedies that are in place and implement changes to make them as green as they can be. Through this RSC GR process that we implemented at Shepley's, that is what we're working towards. The completion of the report is a critical accomplishment, but implementing the recommendations and monitoring those as we move forward will be key to the overall long-term success of the effort. So we will be working towards tracking those changes and reporting those to our EPA headquarters. Please turn to slide 27, which is my last slide. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you have found my experience at Fort Devens and Shepley's Hill Landfill helpful. I will make sure that a full copy, PDF copy of the report from the effort is linked to the resources page so that folks can review the report, the total report, if they'd like to. And Mike, I will turn it back to you.
Thanks, Ginny. I appreciate your time. And now we do have time for a few questions. For those of you on the phone, if you'll press #6, you can take your mute off. Let's start with the phone, and then we'll go to some online questions. Anybody on the phone have questions? Okay, we'll go to, we do have one online question. This is from Gene Wingert from CCILCS, and that's in New Jersey. The RSC study looks very much like a value engineering study. Can you explain the difference? Also, for enforcement lead sites, does EPA expect to ask the PRPs to perform an RSC during the remedial design, remedial action? Ginny?
With respect to the value engineering, it does include many of the concepts of value engineering, and if you go to that EPA guidance manual that I referenced that is linked to the resources page, it talks about that. So I'll refer you to that reference for further information on that. for the second part of the question, Mike, can you refresh me?
Sure. For enforcement lead sites.
Okay. Yeah.
Expect to ask the PRPs to perform an RSE.
I don't know that we have done that at enforcement lead sites. The link that I referred to that's also on the resources page for the RSEs that EPA has implemented since 2000, those were all fund lead sites. Clearly, EPA and taxpayers are paying the bills there, so we were leading those efforts to reduce costs and reduce energy use at those sites. At this site, it's a federal facility lead. The Army is the lead on this site. So EPA partnered kind of with the Army, and we used our contractor to get this work done because we felt it was important here. But I'm not aware of where EPA has pushed RSEs to be conducted at PRP lead sites.
Let's go back to the phone. Anybody have a question from the phone? Okay, another one from online. This is from Angela Fisher. I think that reinjection of treated groundwater is a good idea, particularly in regions where water is scarce. However, many times there are restrictions on reinjecting treated groundwater into an aquifer. Is this something that EPA is considering allowing more leniency?
The Army looked at reinjection of groundwater a while back, and the state did have a concern with respect to anti-degradation rules, and there are also concerns with the, I'm not going to be able to come up with the right word, chloriforms, I can't think of the term, but there are some engineering and state regulatory concerns with reinjection, but we definitely feel that they're surmountable here and that there are a lot of good reasons to pursue it here, and DEP agrees. So the Army's going to look at how best to do it. They may need to add another treatment component in order to do reinjection, but they are going to evaluate that.
Thanks, Jenny. This is from Zach Schreiber from New York City's Mayor's Office of Environmental Remediation. Thanks for the presentation. This may be the same as the first online question, but can you describe any practical distinctions that were made between process optimization and sustainability measures? So practical distinctions between process optimization and sustainability measures. Jenny?
I'm thinking. I think looking at the passive venting system and spark flares for that, that's clearly just a sustainability measure. There's no optimization of the system. That doesn't even relate to the pump and treat system at all, actually. So that's really clearly just a sustainability measure. By looking at the treatment system and looking at the carbon costs and not just the treatment system costs or the cash costs, you know, we also identified things like changing of the chemicals and area suppliers to more sustainable chemicals, things that were located closer to the site that wouldn't have so much transport. And it's not that those chemicals weren't doing their job, so there wasn't an efficiency in the treatment system that will be accomplished by that. That's clearly just to make the operation more sustainable. So that's a couple of things I can come up with off the top of my head.
Also from Zach, you probably discussed this in the presentation, but were any measures presented that were more sustainable and more costly?
Can you repeat that, Mike? I'm sorry. I think someone sneezed in the middle. I missed a piece.
I heard that too. You probably discussed this in the presentation, but were there any measures implemented that were more sustainable and more costly?
It has not been implemented, but the many of them are more costly but have a decent payback. So it makes it a reasonable thing to do for the Army, like the water source heat pump. That for electricity in the building, the Army would have to put out, you know, capital costs to put that, to install that, and then they would realize the cost savings over several years and it would get paid back. And then, like I mentioned in response to the last question, the solar spark flares, which they have not implemented yet, we're still talking to them about that recommendation, that would be a cost only, and there really wouldn't even be a payback. It would only be a carbon footprint reduction payback, not a cost payback on that.
And I think that's, just to butt in a bit, that's an important distinction, that one of the goals here is to reduce carbon footprint, so I think that's a legitimate goal. And we don't know about future energy costs either. While it may look more expensive now, in the future that may change. Let's take another question from the phone. Anybody on the phone have a question? Okay, there are more online. This is from Stephanie Vaughn, US EPA Region 2 in New York. Did you take life cycle analysis of materials into account when considering carbon generation or footprint calculations?
No, we did not.
Another one from online. Why was the landfill gas flared and not captured to generate power?
Only because the landfill was not designed with a gas collection system. It's only designed with passive vents that, so they're these vents, they are not connected to one another, and they just go into just above the waste system and collect gas from there and passively vent it. There is no engineered gas, collection system at this landfill where you could easily collect methane gas and use it for an energy system.
I'll add that our next speaker is going to cover that in quite detail for a case study at a landfill. And to address an earlier question on groundwater reuse, EPA has published a policy clarification report on the reuse of water from treatment systems, and you can download it from that same website, cluin.org/greenremediation. One more chance for people on the phone with a question. Okay, here's one final one from online. This is from Tom O'Neill from New Jersey DEP and the ITRC. We will be interested to see how the spark flares work if installed. We have had mixed experience with them. We've converted from active treatment to passive at one of our landfills, and I may have missed it, but were O&M costs calculated for the flares?
No, they were not. It was just capital costs that Geotrans looked at, and I would be interested in talking to somebody that has experience with installation of them, because I would like to be able to provide the Army with some information, hopefully positive information. It sounds like if they're having mixed results, maybe it won't be. But, I'm not going to be able to get the Army to expend that money, considering all the other things that they have on their plate right now, to do that, unless I'm able to convince them that it's, a very workable solution. So if that person who actually asked that question, if they could email me with any data that they have on use of those, I would appreciate that.
Okay, we're at the top of the hour, so if you've asked a question, don't forget to put your phone on mute. That's *6. Our third speaker is Dr. S.J. Chern. He's an RPM here in EPA's Region 9 office in San Francisco. S.J. Chern is a Superfund Remedial Project Manager, that's an RPM, who has over 10 years of experience managing different Superfund sites, cleaning up, including the OII Landfill Superfund site, that's Operating Industries Incorporated. He joined in 1994 to certify the Department of Energy's Transuranic Waste Repository, that was the WIP project. Prior to his experience with US EPA, Dr. Chern was the lead geotechnical engineer at the US Nuclear Regulatory Commission, overseeing DOE's high-level waste Yucca Mountain project. He was also the a member of U.S. EPA Region 9 Clean Air Initiative and a contributor to the EPA Smart Energy Resources Guide, which came out about a year and a half ago. He manages the OII Landfill Superfund site, which implemented methane to power green remediation technology 7 years ago. Dr. Chern also has extensive experience in the private sector, where he served as a geotechnical / environmental engineer, senior engineer, and technical manager for over 10 years with various companies, including SAIC. He holds a BS degree in civil engineering, MS and PhD degrees in civil and environmental engineering, and he's also a registered professional engineer in civil engineering in the state of California. SJ?
Yes. Okay, Mr. Thank you, Mr. for Michael's introduction. Would you please turn on the next page? Okay. It's page 29. Okay, switch to page 30.
29.
Yeah, 29. Okay. I think this seminar, you know, I try to give you a little bit more practical example, you know, because the site remedy is pretty much already done. And then we take the whole completion to take a look, see how far we can go and what the stuff we can apply to the site. Okay, and that is what the status we are. First things I want to talk to everybody, you know, this is a PRP lead site. So I know this morning some people, you know, asked the question regarding enforcement side, how can we do it? And this is a typical example. And I also want to say something, you know, Stephanie this morning, she mentioned the four goals, you know, regarding with remediation, green remediation. Actually, we already achieved quite a lot. We already consider renewable energy. We already apply the green concrete. We also take consideration of the methane to the landfill, from the landfill. And we want to add more with a site called redevelopment. Okay, so this site is 10 miles east of Los Angeles in the city of Monterey Park. If you look at right-hand side, the pictures is actually the east and the west direction. So the Highway 60, you can see, it cuts through the whole site. The whole site is 190 degrees, cut into the south and north part. So on your right-hand side is the south parcel, which is about 145 acres. And the next slide, you will see, you know, it's about 300 feet above the ground with a very steep slope. And on your left-hand side is the north parcel, which is essentially the flat ground. So if you look at this picture, the turn into the slide 30, that give you the scenario point of view, you know, look at that, you know, how steep the slope is and what the problem we deal with that. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, this slide is a summarized, you know, what the site operations. The site started operating in 1948, received, you know, 26 million, you know, metric tons of trash and about 200 to 300 million gallons of liquid. And we know we have a tons of problems. We have, the methane leaking to the surface. We got the surface erosion. We got that, the leachate seeping to the surface. We have a groundwater problem. We have a tons of problems. That's how EPA stepped in, you know, in 1986, and we started doing the removal work to stabilize the site. So this site got a four rod, okay? The first rod is done in 1987. We call the site control and monitoring. Then we have a leachate management rod, then we have the landfill gas monitoring rod, then we have the final rod did in 1996. It's a groundwater rod. So, you know, start that, we do have a lot of RA, you know, start like a leachate management plan, you know, we started in 1992, and we have quite a lot of remedy until the most current one is covered on the north parcel. We just done about 3 months, 4 months ago. So, you know, right now we just go back to assess where we are and what we can do. Okay, would you please turn into the next page? Well, this just give you a little bit of site history, you know, what the waste we accept on at the site. I don't want to spend too much time in here. We will concentrate on the remedy itself, concentrate on the green remediation. So pretty much that's already said, you know, what is the garbage and what the liquid we receive at the site. Next, please. this is a major milestone what we did. Okay, so, you know, you look at that, all the rod, everything is coming out, what a major milestone. Okay, next please. You know, the remedy strategy, basically, we know we have a lymphoid gas, so we have to deal with a lymphoid gas. So we got to have a lymphoid gas extraction system. We got to have a lymphoid gas treatment system. Okay, and then that we know the leachate, well, the only one thing that we know we can control leachate, you know, is either control that pressure gradient, and we also control that migration of the site. We add all the leachate treatment collector system at the perimeter of the lymphoid. Then we know we have a surface problem, erosion, steep slope problem. We have to put a cover, put the cap on the surface, and apply the institutional control for the long term to make sure, you know, site, you know, remedy at the state as intended or use in the future. So the whole site remedy, if today is a dollar, I just did it about a year ago for the de minimis settlement. The whole site clean up right now, the price is about $750 million. That's not include almost 20 years EPS of spending. It means that all the old spending we didn't add into that, interest. If we incur all the interest that the whole site cleanup will be about $1.2 billion, this is probably one of the largest sites in the EPA Region 9, and probably is one of the largest one, you know, in the whole EPA. Next, please. Okay, slide number 35. Okay, the question now we are having is, well, what we can do at the site? Like I mentioned before, the site remedy pretty much already done. And except that now we have to go back to assess. Okay, let's look at that. You know, the whole green remediation, I will slightly increase, the definition what Mike just said this morning. You know, so the EPA the guidance, green remediation actually is to reduce environmental footprint and maximize the environmental benefit. So the whole project we are looking is from this point of view. So that I said very clearly in the first objective. The second one, you know, while we will look at how can we set the site operations cost, provide additional financial support for the long-term site remediation. So this one, I will go back to Ginny, just mentioned that, you know, we did, the RSC at the site, okay, which is include that you look at all the groundwater, you know, management, you know, groundwater monitoring system, and how can you optimize your sampling, reduce the frequency, reduce the well sampling, because we know we have a lot of redundancy at the site. So that part is already done. And we know we have a lot of methane, okay, that how we going to use the methane, okay. And then we know we have a lot of green space, especially you got 145 acres. On the south parcel and 45 acres on the north parcel, how are we going to deal with that? And this site is a very, very, very good advantage because we have a high voltage power line just next to our north parcel. Because the PG&E, Southern Care Edison is a part of the PRB, they also have their operation substation just next to the site. We know we also will have some remediation, redevelopment in the future on the north parcel, and we know we will have a potential power buyer and also those resources buyer, and that is lead us to think about that why we want to do this. Turn to the next slide, 36. This view graph gives the people the whole idea, you know, what the energy, what we do have, and how can we do the process, you know, to maximize and benefit the site. Okay, like I described before, we have lymphoid gas, we have a surface water we can use, collect from the surface, you know, drainage system and in a pond. Okay, we also have a leachate. We have those liquid. You know, after we treat, how we going to use that? We look at that. we look at opportunity because we have a gas, we have the landfill gas destruction system, which meets 99.999% destruction rate for the VOC. And they can generate about 180 degree Fahrenheit, those kind of temperature, you know. So we look at that, we know what we want to do on that. And we look at 145 acres of the South Paso, and which is about 300 feet above the ground. So you won't see anything from the highway, and it is probably the highest spot in the whole neighborhood. So it probably is an ideal position for the solar panel. Okay, so if you look at these things pretty much, this view graph tell you all what the resources we have and what potential we can do. Okay, next slide, 37, please. So, you know, beginning from that 2002, we know we generate quite a lot of methane. And the methane concentration is higher than 30%. So at that time, we know that the concentration is good for the microturbine. So the PRP installed 6 units of microturbine. It's 70 kilowatt per unit, so they can generate about 420 kilowatt per hour. So in that one, you know, actually we can provide about 60% to 70% of the site power use. And the time they install the whole system, they spend about $1.2 million. But we also have a substantial energy rebate. You know, we got about $500,000 energy rebate from the whole system. So that time when they purchased $1.2 million also includes that 5 years, you know, I mean the warranty. So within 5 years, anything break down, you know, the vendors responsible to repair everything. So we figure out, even include that we spend a little bit aside the staff, you know, to manage the whole system. A year we almost can save about $300,000 to $400,000 energy cost. So, you know, if you ask me a little bit conservative, you know, well, probably got a 3 to 4 years you can pay back. And right now, because we are just, you know, in 7th year, so warranty expire, of course, you know, it's kind of getting harder to find the part. So the energy, you know, producing is dropping. So we are now probably in the 40-50% this kind of range. So we are thinking about to replace, you know, 2 bigger units. Each unit probably got about 250 kilowatt. We can have about 500 kilowatt, you know, the utility, you know, that's to, you know, generation capability at the site. Turn to next. That's slide 38. So in this one, you can see we have a 6-unit microturbine at the site, and all days, yeah, they have about, you know, 60-70% of power generation rate for the site use. Right now, you know, because like I mentioned, it's getting out of date, so now the efficiency is kind of dropping now to 60, now probably up to 50 now. Okay, next please. That's slide 39. Well, like I described, we have a 2 big units of landfill gas treatment system. And though the landfill gas treatment system, you know, they can generate about 66 million BTU per hour of thermal. So, you know, right now we don't do anything yet, but we are really considered to use the CHP, you know, maybe combined with heat and, you know, power generation capacity when we replace the 2 units, you know, which is we are thinking about that, you know, we're adding to the system. And that one definitely, you know, because after that site remediation, we have a lot of, you know, retail stores near the site, which they would need either power or need either heat water or some other stuff. Okay, next please. The slide 40 actually show you the 2 big units of the thermal, you know, destruction system. They are about 60 feet above the ground. and they got a huge capacity. Right now, we are probably running about, 60-70% of the capacity. We can do probably better job, if we optimize everything. Next. This slide basically tell you, while we have about 10 million gallons of liquid we generate at the site. And we have three pieces of the treatment, the liquid control system. And you can see your V-shape, the bottom one, we call the Southwest in early action program area. And we also have another piece on your top on the left-hand side, that's called the Northeast area. And we have the final one, you can see the circle on top of your right-hand side. That is our Northeast area. Next, please. So there are three systems that we can generate about 10 million gallons of the liquid. We have about 450 gas extraction wells. Well, this number is definitely is another 548 because we have a lot of landfill gas extraction wells chip surely off, damaged due to the landfill settlement. We continue to replace that. The same thing, we have 114, groundwater, extraction wells. Those wells, some wells may be dry, so while we are running about 450 gas extraction wells, about 110, groundwater wells. So, we know right now we have a little bit problem regarding the groundwater because, it's treated, but because we still have 1,4 dioxin need to be addressed. If we address the 1,4 dioxin issues, then we can resell those gray water, about 10 million gallons, because the water resources in the Southern California is very critical. So we can resell those gray water to the cemetery and also the nursery, which is it's just next to the site. So at least we know we have an end user near there, so we can do, this kind of green remediation at the site. Next, please. Well, this piece is what we are talking about, that's 145 acres on the south part, which is about 300 feet above the ground. And the top freight deck, we have about 40 to 50 acres, freight deck. So we can install the solar power, and they already have a feasibility study. They know we probably can install about 12 megawatts, electrical capacity, which is almost can generate about power for 9,000 homes to use it. We actually have a proposal to try to lease it, but this is a PRP lead site. So PRP now, we have the steering committee. Unfortunately, the steering committee, we have 8 lawyers sit on the board. So those lawyers, they have a lot of concerns. They say, okay, well, we know we have a lot of liability issues, some other issues. Even people want to lease it, we will get a subsidized, The money looks pretty, but actually, we have to spend more time, more headache. It's not worth it to do it. And that is actually one thing that I'm asking, people, anybody can help and give me some idea how can I push on those issues. So, we know, if the funding side, we have no problem. But this PRP lead side, that's a hurdle I have to jump. Okay? So, move to the next, please. Which is a slide. Okay? Again, like I mentioned before, the 45 acres on the another side of the Highway 60, is a freight ground. So this place is actually, we already have a lot of demolition concrete. So, about 2 years ago, PRP basically, crashed those demolition concrete. And at the price, talking about $4 per cubic yard, this site actually, we generate about between 40,000 to 50,000 cubic yard of crashed concrete. And those concrete, we know we can use, actually we use for the road base for our road repair. And also that the retail place in this area, they will have a big box stores, you know, such as maybe Target or maybe the Home Depot in this area. So they need those concrete. They already ask us to sell those concrete to them. So actually PRP probably makes some money. We sell those fresh concrete, I mean the crushed concrete. So actually this is what part of the Green Remedy we already done at the site. And you can see, you know, after this site, we already finished the cover this summer. So actually, city and the developer are negotiating what they want to do at the site. So we expect, you know, the purchase price will submit to EPA for review probably in a couple of months, within the year, end of the year, tax free. So I already mentioned that, you know, this is what the redevelopment will be done at the north parcel. Let's move into the next slide, 46. During this exercise and during these implementations, I found that we have a lot of problems in the past. For example, you know, the site remedy for the north parcel includes the integration of the redevelopment that actually started in 1999. So that means we delayed the remedy for almost 10 years because developers walk away, developers, I mean, bankrupt. We already have two default on the developers. The current one is the third one. So the problem is you want to integrate everything together, they can save you a lot of money and also save you a lot of O&M costs in the future. But that also creates a lot of headache. The delay, hard to reach agreement, and shareholders, you know, stakeholders, you know, they have a different point of view. You know, cities, they got their own agenda. Everybody got their own agenda. That is why make the deal so difficult to reach. Okay, so we know this site, we did a lot of things. It's after the almost site remedy. So, you know, I mean, if you really are in the early stage of your site remedy, you can consider a lot of stuff, how to integrate everything together. You know, it can make the green remediation more efficient, but the payback is delayed and the time. And actually, it may cost you more money if keeping delay. Okay, this is what is the advantage and disadvantage before the site remedy. And the next slide I want to talk, you know, is after remedy, you know. So, you know, it's very easy because in the future, even the green remediation is there, EPA still needs to spend the time to do the oversight. And during the remedy and the redevelopment, what are the costs, how to spread that? That is a very, very difficult task. And the disadvantage is, well, you know, after your remedy done, a lot of good ideas you may not be thinking or the implement during the early design stage. So, you know, this slide basically tell you, you know, what the trade-off. So that's pretty much end of my discussion today. So I don't know, you know, do you have any questions, and I hope something I can answer. If definitely I will answer your question right away. If something, you know, I don't know, you know, I can take your question and think about that and to give you the answer. Thank you.
Thank you, SJ. We do have time for a few questions. Again, if you're on the phone, to go off mute, it's #6, and then to put it back on mute after, it's *6. Anybody on the phone have a question? Okay, I actually had one online. This is from me. SJ, how many years do you estimate that the site will be able to produce methane that will be usable by the microturbines to produce electricity?
Okay, we already done that study. We know is amazing, probably, right now is probably still gradually decrease about 1 to 2%. Okay, 1 to 2%. So effectively, we still know that the probably we're talking about 20 to 30 years methane. We can do it at the site.
And do you have any idea how many similar landfills there are in the U.S. that could use OII as a model for microturbine use?
I know that another site, I actually just provided a tour for the EPA headquarters staff. at the another site is very close to the OII. It's a BKK site, BKK landfill. You know. So we know it's about 15 miles further east of the OII industrial landfill site. And it is a state lead site. So state is really contact with us is very closely. So they want to borrow a lot of technology, a lot of experience, you know, we can do to help them on that. So yes, we did have a lot of discussions talking about that.
Thanks. Any other questions from on the phone? We'll start with on the phone. And I don't see any more online, so let's move on to our final speaker. Our final speaker for today is Matthew Monsees from EPA's Region 4 office in Atlanta. Matthew Monsees has been with EPA for 24 years. At EPA, he has been a chief in the Superfund contracts and grants section for 5 years, a Region 4 START project officer for 5 years, a Region 4 on-scene coordinator for 8 years, and a Region 9 on-scene coordinator for 4 years. He has worked at the state and university level for 3 years as a pesticide residue chemist and soil science chemist, and he also has 5 years of experience in the private sector as an environmental consultant and with construction firms. Matthew?
Thanks, Michael. And welcome, everybody, to this the second session of this series of webinars. Today I'm going to be talking about contracting perspectives, I guess is the best way to put it, regarding trying to institute green remediation or environmentally sustainable objectives into our contracts that we use. I'm going to go ahead and go to the, and that's going to be centered around a toolkit that's been developed. Carlos Pachone put it together, I think, about 2 years ago. It's still a living document and probably will remain so until it either turns itself into another document or continues on as it is. Now we're on slide 50. The toolkit was developed for use by RPMs and OSCs and contracting and procurement staff to help identify where and how changes can be placed into our contracts to accommodate the new requirements that Superfund has as regards instituting green remediation objectives. And that's a good point to kind of make a point of clarification is that, you know, we in the program, and I'm in the program in Superfund as well, I'm in the program part of the contract side and grant side. We have the requirements. We have the needs and that we identify that we go out and procure services to assist us with. And those requirements change for various reasons, and as time now has progressed the last 5 or so years, environmentally sustainable actions, green remediation has been brought into our arena for ensuring our assessments and implementations of remedies and designer remedies include green remediation considerations. Those are then provided over to the contracts folks to help integrate that into these contracts that we either have or are going to acquire in the future to help us get this work done. So the contract, I guess what I'm saying is the contracting aspect is kind of a secondary thing. It's very essential to what we do to help us be able to implement and ensure we can get the work done that we need to get done. But it is secondary. We define what we want and then we incorporate those requirements into the contract. We have existing contracts, we have new contracts. These contracts, you know, as most of you all know, I'm not really sure who's in the audience. I didn't check the list before I got on. But most of y'all probably know that contracts are long term. We're talking about ERS and RACS contracts primarily, and then to some extent our START contracts and even all of them, quite frankly, even the ROC contract and the F to some to a much lesser extent. But they're long-term contracts. They're 5 to 10 years, typically, or they're in that range anyhow. And once the contract is let, there are fewer ways, let's put it that way, that we can incorporate green remediation aspects into those contracts. For example, reporting. And I'll get into some specifics, but for example, reporting, there may not be reporting may be included in some fixed rate structure. So there has to be, if it wasn't in the initial RFP, then contractors may not have included that as part of their fixed rate. The cost that they of reporting, that additional cost of reporting may not have been included. So there may be some need for allowing for some change in the pricing of the contracts as you want to incorporate those kind of things. But so going down this list, it's, you know, I mentioned it identifies opportunities throughout those various contracts. It cites specific language that's already being used in various. I think all the regions now have clauses in their contracts that relate to green remediation activities, or they have parts of their statements of work that discuss those as well. And the statements of work are, you know, I mean, by that I mean the statements of work of the contract itself, not any particular task order. And then there's also task order specific requirements that are put in place based on the site specific conditions, for example. It does sort of open the door, I guess we can say that, for adding. It's sort of backwards. We should add, this particular bullet is a little bit backwards. As Stephanie had mentioned, Region 2 does have a clean and green policy, and they do have requirements for rods and administrative orders. And when we're doing fund lead actions under the rods, it's important to be able to make sure we have language in our contracts that will allow inclusion of those investigations or other actions to be considered in part of the RIFS RD stages of remedial action, so certain things can be put into rods. It also provides plenty of links of information to various incentives and financing and decision making tools. Those are in the toolkit, and there's also a kind of a building block opportunity put in there for developing the cleanup strategy. So that's the summary of the toolkit itself. A little more background before I go to the next slide. Now, most of you are aware that there was an executive order put out in the Bush administration in 2007. I think it's 13 of 423, and it established, there were other areas where it has been done under the Clinton administration. There were three executive orders that were essentially replaced, or they were replaced by this one that establishes a policy of the United States that we will use essentially environmentally sustainable actions and economically feasible actions. I guess those are the two main considerations in the work that we do at our facilities relating to transportation and many other things. Then there was another executive order which basically set out that this is our policy. So there was some resistance internally here in EPA about, you know, what our limitations could be as regards scopes of services, for example, of contracts. How far can we go to still be able to include green actions and allow it to be included in a scope of work. And that sort of opened doors, opened people's eyes and realized, you know, that there is not that hurdle anymore. So all the contracting offices now, I think, are open to it. And I'll mention one more thing after this. But there is another executive order came out this month, in the last month, under the Obama administration that does a number of different things, but the policy in essence is that it's a policy to increase energy efficiency in various scopes of government operations. Three scopes in particular. Those are defined, and I won't get into that detail. But what it does say, it says that all the agencies will have to come up with a plan sometime by next June or so that addresses the number of various measures and goals in this new policy, in this new executive order, including that it is the goal to have 95% of agency acquisition expenditures be related to those energy efficiency components of this executive order. And it's not only energy efficiency from the standpoint of reducing making your energy more efficient, but also all the second stage, third stage, or components of energy efficiency having to do with, for example, increased recycling, conserving water, all those other aspects that also contribute to saving energy by reducing water consumption, by reusing or recycling materials, by going local and reducing those kinds of energy costs associated with transportation. So it's a good policy that even widens the door further, or makes it wide open for ensuring that we'll be able to fully integrate our contracting strategies into green remediation or sustainable operations. I'll make this final note here before I go on, is that there is a proposed white paper out right now, and those of you all that are in the EPA on this call may or may not be aware of it, but one of the components of the white paper is green remediation, and it's a white paper that is meant to address the reconsideration of EPA's overall contracting strategy. There's a contracting strategy that's in place right now. It's called Contracts 2000, which replaced the long-term contracting strategy. And that's been in place, as it implies, since 2000. The new contracting strategy is going to be called Contracts 2010. And it's important right now, I think, for everybody that's not aware of the component of this contracting strategy, this green remediation component, to try to get as engaged as much as possible. Talk to your contracting officers; they know about it, or your remedial managers; they should know about it in your various regions. And if you feel like you want to contribute to adding your comments, please do that. It's on a fast track right now, I think, to get some information, some recommendations out. I think it's a little bit too optimistic. It might take longer than what they suggest. I think it's something due by February or along those lines, considering the first one took years to put together. But, like, for example, one of the things they're asking for is, what are your recommendations regarding remediation for the next generation of contracts? And this will be applied to the next generation of contracts. You know, most of our contracts have been awarded over the last two or three years, the longer-term contracts. So as those come up for follow-on procurement, by then this toolkit that we have now is going to look completely different if it's not incorporated into something else. And hopefully by then we will have incorporated all the best practices that have been used and incorporate those things into our contracts, both from a pre-award and a post-award standpoint. Getting back to the slide, let me go on to the next slide, which would be 51. Now let's kind of go through some of the highlights of the contracting approach. And some of these things are related to things that actually have happened. Some things are, as you will go through these slides, some things are related to opportunities that can still take place. They're still there and they should be in a toolkit. And in fact, some of these opportunities are now being developed not yet completed. So just kind of keep that perspective. You know, include your green specifications in new or revised scopes of work for your task orders or work assignments. It's a little more difficult to do that once a contract's been in place in regard to contract scope of work. And that's where you can basically have the contractor address anything that's within the main scope of work as regards applying green remediation technologies or actions to that site-specific project. You can also have non-site sort of, not research, but investigative data collection task orders in place to look and see what's available, for example. One thing that was done here in Region 4, there was a supplemental that was produced for the RIFS process, incorporating sustainability into the RIFS process. And, you know, we used our contractors to help us put that together. And, you know, that falls in with our scope of work and probably most others in terms of there are aspects that do allow us to use contractors to help us maintain currency in our program operations. It's that broad because there can be many other things going on. And certainly, you know, maintaining currency and green remediation is directly applicable to that piece of the scope of work. So I guess that's another thing to say is look at your contract, you know, look at your statements of work. If you're having some pushback from your contracting officers and various reasons, and that's probably unlikely, but now might have been more unlikely in the past, kind of point to areas of your contract where you see that that's within the scope of work. Get them to agree to it and put together your task order or work assignment. Let me get back. I'm switching screens here. Consider performance-based contracts. Provide incentives. I know Region 7 has done that quite a bit. We've used some things, some language from Region 7 on our contracts, and those can be put in the task orders as well. Using biofuel, for example, there's a sliding scale of a disincentive in this perspective regarding the use of biodiesel in our particular case, depending on the percent of biodiesel that's used. Include technical evaluation criteria that relate to environmentally sustainable business operations. This is on the pre-award side again, and something that's sort of new. We've been trying it here in the region. We're taking baby steps because it's going to take a while. But we do look at in our corporate management evaluation piece of source selection criteria. We do look to see if those firms, for example, have environmental management systems in place, whether they're living, growing systems, in that there are regular audits, that they're fully supported and advocated by in the highest levels of the business entity, that they're reviewed and updated, they're are incorporated into all aspects of their business operations, especially going past their corporate doors, going out into the field and how they manage, how they conduct their work out in the field with their various clients and how they manage their subcontracts and how they evaluate their subcontractors to help assist in the cleanup. I think that's going to be hopefully my desire to have that become a more substantial piece of the source selection process. There is an ISO 14001 standard in place currently for environmental management systems. I would like to eventually see that there will be a standalone selection criterion that does evaluate environmentally sustainable business operations, looking at past projects, looking at EMS systems, and maybe some other things, and compare those to some specific standards that are that are accepted within their business community or otherwise, like the ISO 14001 standard. And then also upfront standard, established standard reporting requirements related to their proposed green strategies or the the actual actions that have taken place, report the measures that were I'll get into that in a second. Report the measures that were achieved. Let's go on to the next slide real quick here. I'm starting to ramble. The next part of this highlights is during contract performance as opposed to pre-award. Request life cycle analysis, evaluate potential approaches. It doesn't have to be a detailed life cycle analysis. It tends to be costly, so it's a matter of how much you want to fund. And of course, we fund our contractors to do the work, and we incorporate these kinds of requirements into our work plans and approve our work plans to have these things done. There's a cost associated with this, and each site, each RPM, and each region will have to go through whatever process is in place in their regions to be able to allow this to happen. But where you can use life cycle analyses is better because using what you do on site only doesn't always tell the picture. Sometimes it overestimates, or sometimes it underestimates the relative input or footprint or whatever you want to call it for that specific action without including all the other aspects of from the beginning of the time that, for example, water is pumped out of the ground or pumped from a reservoir to the point where it's pumped through the pipes and provided to the site and what happens to it afterwards. So that's important to use life cycle analysis. Look at your remedy screening and your RIFS process to include sustainability factors. There's a lot of references for that already in place that you can link to from the website. I'll show you that location later on. That's also included in the supplemental guidance that I spoke of earlier. That's out right now and being used by Region 4 RPMs, but it's still an internal document. We're having other divisions review it here at Region, and we've sent it out to other EPA folks, including the folks over at in Osready, to review and comment on before we make it final. And I think it was Stephanie that had spoken made mention of the fact that we here in Superfund we don't have any specific programs in place to save energy or conserve water or manage our waste to the maximum extent of recycling. We don't receive appropriated funds to do that like the air division does and or whatever your makeup is for Energy Star and then things associated with water conservation and water sense and waste wise and in the RECRA field. Our RECRA division is a separate division than we are here in Superfund. And it's true that those other divisions, other programs, they really do know a lot more about this than we do, and we, in the same fashion, have brought them to help us in our operations and what makes sense, how you develop, what kind of language, what's the basis for us putting something into a task order, in my basic opinion, I think that as we do our remedial actions and removals and or cleanups in general, we should do that with a cape that has all the other EPA programs behind us, because that's what EPA does as well. They all, besides cleaning up sites, we promote, implement, require a whole host of operations on the rest of the country, regarding at least energy efficiency, a lot of other things, and we should bring all that to our sites and aggressively bring it to our sites, and I think that most of us do that, or want to do that. It's just going to take a while before it's fully integrated.
Matthew, this is Mike Gill, the moderator. I just want to give you a 5-minute warning.
5 minutes?
So we can have a chance for Q&A and then wrap up at the top of the hour as advertised.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate that. I've been watching the time run away real quick, but I tend to go on. I appreciate it. Okay, ensure that negotiated work plan documents and documents all green agreements while preserving remedial objectives. Include reuse planning requirements to ensure long-term protectiveness and sustainability. That's important. I want to elaborate on evaluate contractor performance. That's something that has to be set up prior to your award. You could include that in your performance evaluations. And certainly right now we still use NIH. We're going to probably move to another system, but that's part of our business relations and at least. You can go through the rest of the list. Some of the examples, you'll see that reporting requirements are there. Those you have to be careful to try to have as much as possible that in place prior to the award, because you know costs of monthly reports will have to be considered and depends how they're developed. Maybe even certain types of expertise, I doubt that, might have to be considered by the contractor if they're going to put together a bid or something like that. Using clean technologies, clean green policy in place, and reasons associated with that. Professional qualification management ability, talked about that. Using renewable energy, that list has expanded greatly as far as the reasons using it. Specialized experience, technical competencies, environmental preferable practices, that's what a lot of these other previous ones were. They can all be captured in the general term of environmentally preferable practice. And there's a definition for that, too. And then next bullet being those practices as regards providing monthly reports on activities. And here are some of the tools that can be accessed. First one, for example, waste reduction model. That's something that you know that is used to, if you're not familiar with it, is used to be able to calculate a baseline and then maybe a modified approach to how you handle municipal waste products from sites. It doesn't really address dealing with any kind of hazardous waste. It's really mostly related to either comparing dumping it to a landfill versus doing some kind of alternative waste management practice. Reuse, recycle, composting, those kind of things. That's it. Briefly, we now have 8 minutes. How's that sound, Michael?
That's great, Matthew. Thank you very much. We do have time, one last time, for some questions and answers. Let me start with the phone. If you take your phone off mute, to take it off mute, you could hit #6, and then to put it back on is *6. So anybody have any questions on the phone?
Anybody left?
I'm sure there are people out there.
Okay.
No questions. I don't see any online as well. Do you want to just kind of wrap up a little bit, Matthew? You do have a couple minutes, I guess.
Sure. I want to kind of go back to a couple things that I'd mentioned is that there is this white paper that's going to be put out, and it's a great opportunity for program folks to, especially the folks that are working with green remediation actively, is to make recommendations and suggestions about how to incorporate these requirements into our next generation of contracts. This is the chance to do it, and it could probably make, if you have good suggestions and they can be put through the process, this is the time to get them in place now and early so that they'll be fully functional when we start awarding new contracts. In the meantime, you have to involve your contracting acquisition folks in any kind of modifications or adding language that's not the normal language into your task orders, or if you want to add clauses, that's certainly a possibility. Bilateral clauses are being added all the time if the contractor, agrees to it. And just work on those things, Get with your contracting staff and work on that. You see my email, my phone number is 404-562-8749. 562-8749. Feel free to call me. There's folks here in the region that are RPMs that are aggressively working on this, and they can give you some real insight as to what they've been doing here and how we're using our contracts to get things done. So please contact us. We'll be glad to help you out any way we can.
Matthew, two questions did come in online. The first is from Tom O'Neill, New Jersey DEP. Any plans to require states to include any green contract language on sites managed under state Superfund contracts or cooperative agreements?
Well, I'll tell you what. We are, I would say probably, it's probably coming. I mean, I don't know what Region 2 does in particular, but we here in Region 4 are working also on a sort of a greening, clean and green policy to make it the policy of the region. And once that becomes a policy of the region. I will be, we manage the cooperative agreements and contract out of this section as well, or they're originated out of here and passed the RPMs for management, that we will incorporate those kinds of policy provisions into our terms and agreements into the cooperative agreements and add clauses to the state contracts.
And one more final one from online. Thanks for the presentation. This is from Zach Schreiber, New York City. How can these contractual ideas be implemented in a voluntary program? Do you have any ideas about how these could be made into incentives?
Well, you know what? There are incentives. Let me pull up something that NASA has done. And it's a contractor incentive. Is where they have a clause in their contracts. I'm not sure how exactly they work it out, but, you know, because I can see some, it's not as straightforward as it seems at first blush. But, you know, they have clauses that they put in their contracts called sustainable proposals. And well, they'll make available a certain percent, they use 1%, but a certain percent of the contract or a task order award amount for incentive payments to the contractor to encourage sustainable engineering efforts that support the goals of the Executive Order 13423. Contractors is encouraged to develop, prepare, and submit a sustainable change proposal voluntarily during execution of the contract that support the goals. Each proposal can identify specific actions to be taken, provide an explanation of how those actions support the goals of the order, propose metrics evaluating success of the actions, and propose a value for the incentive payment. Then in turn, the contracting officer reviews that, and they either approve it or they approve it with modifications as regards any one of the pieces. And once the contractor achieves their goal, then the incentive payment is made available to them. So, and it talks about partial payment may be awarded at the discretion of the contracting officer if the metrics for evaluating success of the action are not fully achieved. So there's various ways of writing it. So agencies are doing that right now. In respect of that, we haven't done that at EPA, not that I know of. We do provide incentives right now for using biofuels. We do provide incentives now for using local resources, and that serves several objectives, trying to help meet socioeconomic goals, putting our funds, those Superfund monies, putting them into the local economies as opposed to, you know, somewhere else, and also reducing the carbon footprint of things that require transportation and those sorts of things. So those are some, we have some things in place now. Other agencies are doing probably, I don't know, I guess I would say they have more incentives, but yes, they're in place.
Matthew, thank you very much. That's about all the time we have, folks. I would point you again to that all-important webpage, the cluin.org/green remediation. Thanks to Matthew and all of today's speakers, and of course to all of you out there for your questions. That concludes today's Green Remediation presentations. Please take the time to fill out the feedback survey. It's available online, and there's a link at the last page. Help us improve for the next session. And also on this, you'll find related resources. Among those resources is a call for abstracts for the upcoming Green Remediation Conference at UMass Amherst, which EPA is co-sponsoring. This is in June 2010. Please consider submitting an abstract while you still can. They've extended the call for abstracts by a few days, so you still do have time. And remember, when we have our final session in this Green Remediation Series on December 15th, please check cluin.org for more information and space availability. We're going to have a little bit more on case studies, regional policy, and also headquarters policy. These talks represent NARPM, which happened about 6 months ago, but again, you can stay up on the latest on green remediation on that webpage, cluin.org/green remediation. And thanks for your time. Take care, everybody.